Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece was brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, cane5.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What I did was escape. How did I escape? We had no books in my house. We were a science family entirely. We had the Bible. And we had scientific manuals. How did I escape? Movies. God bless the movies. So from age 5, I would go off and live in that imaginary world with my grandpa, who would take me on Saturday matinees. I lived the movies. So I would play out Marie Antoinette. I am Katharine Hepburn. I am Jeanette MacDonald. I am Deanna Durbin. And above all, I am Shirley Temple.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Betty Fussell. Betty Fussell is an American success story and one of the most celebrated and beloved writers in food. Over the last 50 years, her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, Savoir, Vogue, Food and Wine, and many more varied publications. Her memoir, Kitchen Wars, was performed in Hollywood and New York as a one-woman show by actress Dorothy Lyman. She's written more than 11 books and has taught courses in English literature, food writing, and food history. Betty has seen it all and remains as sharp as the young writers making waves in today's food world.
The piece that really, for me, launched writing about food was The Beautiful Birds of Brest, B-R-E-S-S-E, the beautiful birds of that part of France that had the most beautiful birds in the world and almost still does. And that was 1969 for the old holiday. And that's because the editor there would take a chance on me. He had never heard of me, but I wrote mostly during this time for the New York Times because they were beginning, the living section. It seems prehistoric at this time. The shift from home economic pages or to something involving food and life. Good God. And Annette Grant Hedden, who is the editor that kind of picked me up there, was very patient with me because I knew absolutely nothing about newspaper, nothing about newspaper writing. But through that wonderful training of becoming the restaurant review editor for New Jersey, impossible task. This is in the 70s. It gave me the necessity of writing anything you had to say in 750 words. Didn't matter what you said. You had to be no more than 750 words. And that was extraordinarily good training, and I advise it for all my writing students from there on. Get yourself a deadline, and that's, you have no invaluable words. You have a time limit, a space limit, and that's what it is. And you can write the history of man in a tweet. As I've said, long before tweets existed, you can write the history of man in two words. Adam died. I went to Rutgers because that was, Princeton would not take me. They had no female graduate students then. I have a wonderful rejection letter, which I treasure, which said, we have never had female graduates at Princeton. That has been our tradition, and we have no regrets on that account. Yes, okay, that was the attitude. Harvard would require me to, Harvard and Columbia would require me to be a full-time student, and I didn't think I could do that and run a household. And it would also, I was not going to get credit for my languages tests. I would have to take those all over again. I thought, oh, my God, I'll just go to Rutgers, even though I don't like the idea of teaching with where friends are my instructors. You know? But I had a wonderful, wonderful time studying. You see, I really like studying. So I got to do my thesis on Shakespeare and tragicomedy. I love the form of tragicomedy because that brings for me together what I love about movies, the popular culture, and the nature of a very mixed form. This has to do with food because American food is mixed. That's its nature. That's the nature of our culture. And what I'm really looking for all the way through is, what is it to be an American? That's, I've always felt strongly that's who I am. I could never be an expat in any country. And what does that mean? Because of my luckiness in going to movies, I've always felt strongly attached to popular culture rather than haute culture, rather than any French hierarchical or European hierarchical tradition. It seems to me that the egalitarian is us, at least as an ideal, even though we contradict that all the time with our various clubs and snobberies and fashions. Naturally, we're human. Okay, but this fits for me, tragicomedy as a form, because it doesn't have the status of high tragedy. Notice the Oscar ceremony, you know, who gets the Oscars? Very seldom does a comedy. A comedy is a low popular form. So I've taught courses in comedy. My first book was a biography of Mabel Normand because she was a comedian, a silent film comedian. So this is the basic underlying. These are the impulses that have driven my interest in food, and food is just a wonderful place to keep on exploring these particular interests.
Betty was born and raised in Riverside, California, but like many of her contemporaries, it wasn't until she visited Europe that she realized food could be so incredible.
The extraordinary moment of change, I've always loved this, was Craig Claiborne, who said 1947 was when America changed forever. And I go with this kind of dramatic date. That's when Pan Am Airline took its first round-the-world trip for non-military, and it cost $1,700, which at the time was considerable. But in relation to the costs of who was able to go traveling abroad across the Atlantic with frequency on the great transatlantic liners, these were the very rich. And suddenly the whole middle class could go travel and did. Even my cousins in Nebraska went off to places like Japan. Much more likely they went to places like Europe because somebody in their family had served during the war. That's why I got to Europe. I was determined to get to Europe because of Shirley Temple in the movie Heidi, believe it or not. So I had an image of Europe as this wonderful, magical land of green meadows, loving grandpas, sheep and cows, and butter and cheese. That image remained. So when I graduated from college, I had saved up enough money in one little job in San Francisco to get to New York by sitting up on a train for 5 days. This would be remarkable to people who have never done that. Landing in New York and was going to save enough money if I could, although I was paid, $30 a week? And this is the cost of subway, was that? Anyway, it was very hard to save any money, and I came with a $25 war bond to New York, so I didn't have any money. This was going to be my step from New York to Europe, and then I got married instead to a boy I'd met in college, and we stayed east. Why did we stay east? So we could travel to Europe all the time, because travel became so cheap during the 50s and 60s, the glory years of the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, largely by boat across the water, but those boats were faculty and students, because that was the new travel population, and veterans. So that's how everybody got eventually to France. And in France, there was real food that none of us except the vets had tasted it if they'd been posted to France. But the rest of us home fronters had never had bread and butter before. Oh, my God. This is the Julia Child discovery. This is James Beard's discovery. MFK Fisher's before that. Alice Waters after that. And this was the big moment in which America said, oh, my God, What have we been missing all this time? And that has never changed, that part of joy in the discovery of real food. I was cooking entirely out of the four people that I wrote the Book of Masters of American Cooking on. I mean, for me, M.F.K. Fisher, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, Julia Child. And I learned how to cook out of books because I knew nothing about cooking. I'm a literary person. That was all my training. And I certainly knew nothing about food. So I learned through books. And as I read these and I came through, each of these are good writers. So I came to each of them through their words. I thought, oh, gee, you know, I can do that. But I didn't care about whether it was an authentic anything. I always would check who says how many. Let's check Beard against Craig against Julia on any of these to see what the basis of the recipe is, which is why I love the world of Google and Google recipes. I don't want those horrible, fractured, pretend lab, home ec tradition of we are scientifically measuring. You know, that came in. It was not a universal. This is not a universal thing at all. It was very much a home ec that came out of America's desire to give food status and women's status by making it into a pretend science, a home economics.
Betty married her college sweetheart, Paul Fussell, in 1949. And early in Betty's writing career, she edited many of Paul's works of literary criticism and military history. In 1981, the couple divorced.
I couldn't have written the books I wrote and be married. A, because I was married to a writer. B, I was married to a guy who was extremely insecure about gender, sexuality, everything. Three, he took a Victorian stance on this. And so I knew that I was going to have to remove myself physically. I began renting apartments in New York from friends, and where I would go 3 days a week to write. And then I taught at the new school. So I'd keep my teaching arm in and taught comedy and movies and things that are a lot of fun, and researched Mabel at the Performing Arts Library, where they had a really, really good library. And then I, you know, would take a trip to California by myself and research out there, and he got more and more resentful of that from his point of view, understandably, because I was supposed to be home taking care of him. So I knew that I would have to get away to have some place to write by myself in order to do anything at all. I would never have made the split if I realized I could stay alive. This was survival time in the 70s. It's the only way I had come to that. I knew I was not going to survive if I kept on. And my God, this was glorious. I mean, I wrote 15, 18 hours a day, and it was like the cork out of the champagne bottle. It was wonderful. I had nothing to distract me. I didn't have to take care of anybody. I could just write and, you know, discard, write and rewrite, discard, then pedal. So the eternal writer's dilemma. You know, you're not writing for yourself. You're writing for someone to listen to you who's out there listening.
Betty was born on July 28th in 1927 and was very much a child of the Depression. She didn't get a chance to enjoy many foods growing up, and perhaps it was that deprivation that drove her to break the tradition she was raised in.
Food was castigated. It was a necessary evil. Why was it evil? Because it was attached to the body. Why was the body evil? Because the body was everything the spirit was not. This is the early division of the Puritan culture from which I came. This is the simple world of, you know, good and evil. Good was Protestantism, and within that, Calvinism, and within that, the particular sect. We were United Presbyterian. Anything to do with pleasure was forbidden. That certainly included food. Food was a fuel. Well, that's why it was so much fun to carry on the rebellious tradition against my own tradition, which is, again, part of the tradition. The staples were mayonnaise, Ovaltine, Postum, coffee substitute, because all stimulants are bad, cornmeal mush, bread and milk. Because it's California, oranges were actually a staple. Orange juice was a staple. That was the good thing. There were no green vegetables of any kind. And if there were, they had to be pressure cooked and steamed, you know, for hours and hours with whatever little lamb shank, which was extremely costly and therefore expensive and never done. But it all had to be reduced to in effect liquid into a mush texture. This is partly because there were always one set of grandparents or another living in the same house, and they, of course, had no teeth. Even their dentures were imperfect. So, you know, you wanted to slurp your food. The blander, the better. That included salt and pepper. So the ideal was to reduce all foods to liquid because, in effect, the point was to get rid of it as quickly as possible because it is evil. So you ingested this in order to get rid of it. If you didn't get rid of it, you had your weekly colonic irrigation to get rid of it for you. It's a very limited view of the world. Within three generations, if you think of what three generations the changes have been, so at 86, I've lived most for a long part of the last century, and my grandparents would have begun in the mid-19th century with the Civil War. And my grandma Kennedy had a cousin who was a soldier in the Civil War. From that time, they moved from farms. My grandfather died in the 1940s. He had never, ever been in an airplane. My father had never been in an airplane. And, you know, I've spent most of my 80 years traveling, which willy-nilly means airplanes. We went from letters to radio to television to digital iCloud. The hugeness of the iCloud revolution cannot be understated because we can't take it in. But I really delight in it because it is thrilling. Now, because of the shift, I love the quick take. I love the world of blogs. I really do think, you know, it has its own art form. The tweets the same way. The influence of the visual, what has happened, the shift to the visual. And this totally affects our attention span as readers, our focus as readers, and as writers. And I love the multi-screen. I love the quick cuts on plots, the 25 narratives going at once. keep awake, because you will have missed it if you blink your eye. And the influence now of television serials, I mean, of the productions of, like House of Cards and A True Detective, The Americans. Oh, my God, I think these are important and wonderful, and they seep into the culture in different ways. Certainly, they affect the world of cookbooks. I mean, cookbooks are now stuck in a lot of old-fashioned narratives. The form is always, you know, conventional and drags, and it's always out of date. But the on-the-screen cookbooks. Who needs books when you've got, I mean, they serve a different function, and I'm the first to love books, but on the screen you have a whole different experience and a whole different function of, oh, I can make that in a minute. All these food bloggers. Well, more power. You know, you select out, I don't want to read that. I certainly don't want to read those comments. Those sound very blah and dull and opinionated. And of course they are. That's what they're for. But that's a whole shift. The shift away from authority, I think, is enormously exciting for an old protester like me. When the food war was French, I was American. when you had to have a recipe to publish a book about food, I had no recipes. I got bad reviews from Publishers Weekly, et cetera, et cetera. But as you can tell, I don't care. I have always been in a minor rank because I am a generalist, and that works against you in a world that is professionally very specialized. And I've always known that and don't care because I see things horizontally and have refused. I refused to major in college. I couldn't. What do I have to major for? So I majored in philosophy first and then in English. But what I was really interested in was in the history of ideas. Well, they didn't have a course called the history of ideas. That's one of the reasons the food studies course has been so wonderful. Of course, they didn't have that with academic departments and specializations. So it was a big revolutionary thing to cross interdisciplines. Oh, wow. You know, and have food as a subject. Oh, my God. What was it? I mean, was it a science? Was it an art? Was it a sociology? So the fracturing, I'm always moving against. I'm always moving to collect rather than fracture. So where I am in current food, I mean, I'm a very old person who wrote about food history at a time when there was no such subject as food, let alone history. Those are divisions I have never recognized anything, ever, about anything. So the future of food is the future of life. So what's going to happen to human beings on the planet? Is that a fair question? It's a question we ask because we're so good, we're so efficient at ruining life on the planet. So food is a part of that. And whether you're optimistic or pessimistic means what you embrace. I embrace life as a tragicomedy, not, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. You just know that humans are both foolish and noble and both idiots and aspire towards sainthood. And so it's that mixture that will remain as long as humans remain. We can always kill ourselves off, but if we do, we'll kill ourselves off through food. We discover that food is at the root of everything.
This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research by Talia Ralph. The songs used in this piece, in order of appearance, are Welcome to the World by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Frog and Toad by Archipelago, Never by Jerome LOL, Dues Paid by Rectech, The Old Photographer by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Troy by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Street Trees by Comanche, Naps by Space Ghost, and again, Welcome to This World by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization broadcasting 35 live shows a week. For more and to donate, visit our website or connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Stitcher, Instagram, Tumblr, and more. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.